Oris is an important figure in this part of the country. As important as you, I said. Del Rio consulted the chessbook and studied the board and moved another piece. Not to me, he said. Me either, I said. What's Tannenbaum do for a living? Del Rio smiled. He's a venture capitalist, Del Rio said. Like me. What's he invest in? Drugs, whores, numbers, usual thing. Competition, I said. Not really, Del Rio said. He operates east of Chino. The Inland Empire? Del Rio nodded, studying the chessboard. Fresno, he said. Bakersfield, San Berdue, Riverside. Where would I find him? Del Rio moved a chess piece, kept his hand on it for a moment, and moved it back. He continued to stare at the board. Cholo was motionless. Palm Springs, Del Rio said. Maybe I should go out and talk with him. Del Rio smiled and moved a chess piece, sat back, and looked at the move with satisfaction. It would save you the drive if you were to shoot yourself here. Morris is not friendly.
No.
Is he persistent?
Very.
So he'll admonish me again, I said. Del Rio looked at Cholo.
Admonish, he said. Even for a gringo, he talks funny, Cholo said.
Yes, Del Rio said. He will admonish you again. So maybe I'll need backup, I said. Del Rio looked again at Cholo. Cholo was studying the board. Without looking away, he said,
Backup.
That would be the second favor, Del Rio said.
Si.
You wish to borrow Cholo?
Like last time, I said, and Bobby Horse, too, if you would. Del Rio leaned back in his chair and stared at me.
They are not mine to lend, he said.
Then I'd like your permission to make them a proposal. Again the silence and the stare. Cholo looked amused. Against the wall, Bobby Horse showed nothing. His strong-featured Indian face was entirely blank. Finally, Del Rio said,
That is respectful.
I'm a respectful guy, I said.
In this instance, Del Rio said.
A small bird with a black back made small syncopated noise in the olive tree. Del Rio looked at Cholo and then at Bobby Horse.
Do you wish to listen to his proposal, he said.
Si, Cholo said.
Bobby Horse shrugged and nodded. I need some help with this guy Tannenbaum, I said. And I need a few hard cases to go out to the desert with me and clean up a town.
Clean up the criminal element?
Cholo said.
Yeah.
We are the criminal element, Cholo said.
Yeah, but you're not their criminal element.
What do you want with Tannenbaum?
Cholo said. I don't know, but it must have something to do with the thing in the desert.
So you clean up one, you clean up the other?
Si.
I didn't realize you spoke our language, Cholo said.
Si. If you were to succeed in this, Del Rio said, it might provide me an opportunity to expand eastward. If Tannenbaum went down, I said.
Si.
I looked at Cholo. He's fluent too, I said.
Tannenbaum don't bother me none, Cholo said. What about the desert business? You figure your criminal element can beat their criminal element?
That's my plan, I said.
How big is their criminal element?
30, 40 guys.
And ours?
With you and Bobby Horse, I said, there would be 7.
Including you?
Including me, I said. Which really makes it 17. As you know, my strength is as the strength of 10.
10 what?
Cholo said.
You paying? Bobby Horse said.
Big time, I said.
How much?
I told him. He looked at Cholo.
I saved his ass once before, Cholo said. He's sort of fun for an Anglo.
Bobby Horse looked at Del Rio.
Mr. Del Rio?
I don't have a problem with it, Del Rio said. Cholo?
No problem.
Okay, Bobby Horse said.
Can you make the phone call? I said to Del Rio. To Tannenbaum. I want to visit him without being fired upon as I come up the driveway.
I'll have it made, he said.
Gracias. Del Rio grinned.
Si, he said.
Chapter 31. In a dark brown Range Rover, laden with brush gear and sonorous with stereo, with Bobby Horse driving and Cholo beside him, and me in the back seat, we cruised down Palm Canyon Drive, through Palm Springs, on Racquet Club Road, and into Morris Tannenbaum's circular crushed stone driveway. Beyond the house, a golf course rolled toward the mountain. The house itself was modest for Palm Springs, with the usual stuccoed walls and red-tiled roof. It looked like a dozen other homes with access to the golf course, except for the tastefully understated security cameras and the black Lincoln Town Car that sat outside with its motor running. Cholo took a Derringer from the glove compartment and put it over the sun visor. We parked beside the Lincoln. After a moment, the door opened on the passenger side, and a tall, leathery guy in a cowboy hat and Oakley shades got out and walked over to us. Cholo lowered his window. The cowboy looked in at me in the back.
"That him?" he said.
"Si," Cholo said.
The cowboy looked at me some more, then straightened and jerked his head toward the house.
"Okay," he said.
Bobby Horse shut off the motor and we got out into the heat, walked to the front door and rang the bell. A Filipino houseboy answered and bowed us into the air-conditioned hallway.
"Please to wait here," he said,
and went down the hall and disappeared. In a few moments, a man came out of the door where the Filipino had gone and walked to us. He was a well-built guy, like a racquetball player or a tennis pro. He had a crew cut. He was wearing a blue seersucker suit and a blue Oxford shirt with a button-down collar, a blue and red striped tie, and horn-rimmed glasses. As he came down the hallway, he was looking at Cholo. I glanced over. Cholo was looking at him. When he reached us, he stopped. Still looking at Cholo, he said,
"You wish to see Morris?"
"Yes," I said.
5 minutes, he said.
"Plenty," I said. Cholo and the suit continued to look at each other. Then the suit said,
"Follow me,"
and turned and went back down the hall. We followed him into a smallish room that looked out through glass doors at a modest pool, and beyond to the green of the golf course. A big-screen television set on a high shelf was blasting out a rollicking symphony of canned laughter. The room was full of exercise equipment. Nautilus, Kaiser, Cybex, a complete set of chrome-plated free weights. A flabby, unshaven guy in a yellow sweatsuit was doing assisted dips on a gravitron. There was a stair climber and an exercycle, and a treadmill all arranged so that they faced the television. The bicycle had a reading stand attached, and around it, on the floor, were scattered parts of the Los Angeles Times and the Wall Street Journal. Several half-consumed bottles of Gatorade stood around. One had tipped over and was puddling the floor. The man on the gravitron had a thick crop of dark black hair. His unshaven stubble was gray. The contrast was a little suspicious. I noticed that the counterweight on the gravitron was set as high as it would go, which meant that he was dipping very little weight.
"Ronnie," the man said, still on the gravitron, "the room's a fucking mess."
Without a word, the suit who let us in went to a desk beside the door and pressed the button. The flabby guy climbed down off the gravitron and wiped his face with a towel and took a big pull of Gatorade.
"I'm Morris Tannenbaum," the flabby guy said. "What do you want?"
The Filipino came silently into the room and folded up the newspapers, picked up the Gatorade bottles, cleaned up the spill, and went silently out. Ronnie stayed by the door looking at Cholo, who was looking at him. Bobby Horse stood just behind me, motionless. I glanced at him. His face had no expression. "My name's Spencer," I said. "I wonder why you sent Jerome Jefferson and his friend Tino to scare me out of my wits."
"Don't know Tino," Tannenbaum said. "Jerome must have recruited him. I sent Jerome because I thought he could take care of things. I was wrong."
"What things did you want taken care of?"
"I want you to forget about Steve Buckman. I want you to stay away from Lou Buckman, and I want you to forget about the Dell."
"Uh-huh.
And if you don't do what I want, I'll have you killed."
"How come?" I said.
Because I say so, that's how come. You think because you get Del Rio to call me, and you bring a couple of his greasers to back you up, that somehow makes you different from every other two-bit cheapie I've put in the fucking ground?
I'm the greaser, Cholo said, still looking at Ronnie. He tilted his head toward Bobby Horse.
He's an Indian.
Tannenbaum made a little dismissive gesture with his hand and kept his eyes on me.
You heard me, he said.
I did, and I'm trying to get my breath back, I said.
Okay, Tannenbaum said. You've been told? Straight up, from me to you. Beat it.
What's your interest in Lou Buckman, I said, or the Dell?
This is my home, Tannenbaum said. I do not wish to kill you here, but I'll kill you somewhere, and soon.
Tannenbaum got up and walked out. Ronnie went out after him and closed the door. In another minute, the Filipino came in.
May I show you out? He said.
I said he might. We got back in the car, drove back out to Route 10, and headed for L.A., past the Indian bingo parlors and the places that sold famous date shakes.
Ronnie looks sort of like an accountant, I said to Cholo. He's not, Cholo said.
No, I said, he's not.
You think Tannenbaum will try to kill me?
In your language, Cholo said, you bet your ass.
Well, it's been tried before, I said.
You want me to kill him? Cholo said.
No, but I might take a rain check.
What's the Dell? Bobby Horse said.
You don't know, I said.
I did what I'd be asking.
But Tannenbaum did, I said.
So his interest is not just what's-her-name, Cholo said.
Lou Buckman.
No,
it's Potshot.
So, what's the Dell? Bobby Horse said.
I told him.
Tannenbaum connected with this preacher hombre, maybe?
Cholo said.
Hombre, I said.
Just like to stay authentic to my heritage, Cholo said.
Cholo, you grew up in East L.A., I said.
And I'm true to my heritage, Cholo said. I am a thug.
And a good one, I said.
A thing worth doing, Cholo said, is worth doing well.
You got a plan, Bobby Horse said.
I can't seem to connect any of the dots, I said. So I think I'll blunder around out here some more. Something's got to be connected to someone.
There's a connection, Cholo said. You just don't know what it is.
Story of my sleuthing career, I said.
Chapter 32. One of the things I always liked, especially when I traveled with Susan, was to have breakfast with her. The only drawback was that, no matter when you woke up, you waited an hour or so to eat while she worked out, showered, did her hair, put on her face, and dressed like a Parisian model. I had never actually met a Parisian model, but I was sure that if I did, she'd be dressed like Susan. The thing was that without her clothes on, with no makeup and her hair down, she was gorgeous. Occasionally, I remarked about carrying coals to Newcastle, and always, when I did, she gave me a look of such penetrating pity that I never pursued it. The way we normally worked it was that she said she'd meet me in the dining room at, say, 9 a.m., and I should go down and get a table for us. So I would, and have some juice and coffee and study the menu, and she would show up about 9:30 without any apparent awareness that she was a half hour late. On the other hand, she wasn't reliable. If I went down at 9:30, she would have showed up before me, and, in the future, would expect me to be a half hour late. So, next time, she'd show up at 10. It is one of the secrets of happiness that you know which battles you can win and which you can't. I had given up the punctuality battle years ago, and the pleasure of her company when she did show up was always worth the wait. I had drunk some orange juice and read USA Today and was on my second cup of coffee at a table for two near a window when she came gleaming into the dining room. Several people looked at her more or less covertly. Maybe she was a movie star.
I'm sorry I'm late, she said.
Really? I said. I didn't notice.
Do you know what you're going to have? She said.
Here's a how well do you know me test, I said. Read the menu, see if you can guess. Susan put on the reading glasses she had just bought on Rodeo Drive, round ones with bright green frames, and studied the menu. She smiled.
Aha, she said.
And your answer is?
Huevos Rancheros, she said.
You win, I said.
Good. What have I won?
I smiled at her without speaking.
Oh, Susan said.
That. When the waiter arrived, Susan ordered decaffeinated coffee and a fresh fruit platter with yogurt. I kept my date with the Huevos Rancheros.
Other than a threat to my life the other night outside that restaurant, Susan said, I've been having a very nice time. How about you?
The time we've spent together has been nice, I said.
Isn't it always, Susan said.
But other than that, I feel like the more I learn, the less I know.
Do you know who it was that threatened us?
Guy named Jerome Jefferson, I said, sent by a man named Morris Tannenbaum.
How about the other man? Tino?
No record. Haven't located him. The guess is he's a day player hired by Jefferson for the occasion. The food arrived. Susan ate a raspberry.
Why would this Tannenbaum person want to threaten us?
He wants me to stay away from Lou Buckman, Potshot, the Dell, and the west side of the continent.
He mentioned the Dell?
Yep.
Then he's involved, she said.
You get sick of shrinkage, you could get a license and join me. Spencer and Silverman, Investigations.
She picked up a wedge of cantaloupe with her fingers and took a small bite off the end of it.
I could never figure out why I was eating with my hands when I did that. When she did it, she was elegant.
Alphabetically, it's Silverman and Spencer, she said.
But I'd be senior partner.
And I'd be main squeeze, she said.
Silverman and Spencer, I said. Investigations.
So how is Tannenbaum involved?
I don't know. Have you learned anything more about Lou Buckman, the little blonde cutie?
You sound jealous, I said.
So?
You haven't even met her.
So? Apparently all was not as it seemed with the Buckmans. They don't seem to be too well liked by former colleagues and neighbors. It is alleged that they both slept around. One interesting factoid, both Mark Ratliff and Dean Walker lived in the Buckmans' old neighborhood in Santa Monica. Ratliff seems to have had an affair with her. And the former Mrs. Ratliff had a get-even affair with Steve Buckman.
Walker is the police chief in Potshot, Susan said. Who's Ratliff?
I told you about him, I said. The producer. Moved to Potshot to get away from the Hollywood rat race.
Susan smiled. Where, I assume, he was running a dead last.
I've heard, I said, that people with a three-picture deal don't usually seem to suffer the same moral revulsion.
Susan dipped a small wedge of pineapple into her small cup of yogurt and took a small bite. So what are you going to do now?
When in doubt, I said, go home.
Oh, good, Susan said.
Getting bored?
Getting homesick, Susan said.
Pearl, I said.
Yes, I miss her.
Yeah. You talk with Farrell at all?
Of course. He says she's sleeping with him every night. Says it's his first female.
Man, is she easy, I said.
She's just a friendly girl, Susan said.
Chapter 33 It was September in Boston, which normally means early fall. When I went to work the morning after I got home, the day was bright blue and 70 degrees. The first hint of color was beginning to show in the leaves of some trees. Once again, pennant fever was not gripping the hub, and there wasn't a starlet in sight. My first assignment was to catch up. Catching up meant mostly throwing away junk mail without reading it. But there was my answering machine to listen to. Since I'd been gone, there were 8 new messages. One was from Frank Beltson inviting me and Susan to have dinner with him and Lisa. One was from a young Chinese girl named Mei Ling, who wanted to use me as a job reference. One was from Samuelson in L.A. with instructions to call him. "Couple of sheriff's deputies found your pal," Jerome Jefferson, Samuelson said when I got him, beside the PCH up near Topanga Canyon. Dead, I said. 9mm, once, behind his left ear. Think it happened there, or was he dumped? Coroner says he was dumped. Suspects? None. Leads? None. Clues? Come on. Chances of solving this? Samuelson laughed. Around zilch, he said. Tannenbaum, I said. Probably, Samuelson said. Wasn't satisfied with Jerome's job performance. There's a girlfriend on Franklin Avenue, I said. She might know something. Name and address? I told him. Get there early, I said. She should be drunk by noon. Wish I were. Cop's life is a hard one, I said. Could you get me the record of a former cop named Dean Walker? Used to live in Santa Monica. I don't know if he was LAPD or Santa Monica. Glad to, Samuelson said. If I didn't have legwork for you, I wouldn't have anything to do. Thank you. You're welcome, Samuelson said. Call me when you know something. If I'm not here, leave it on my machine. I may be traveling. Pay attention while you are, Samuelson said. Morris Tannenbaum is a genuine bad guy. The real thing. All the way to Boston, I said. Wherever, Samuelson said. If he thinks it's a good thing to do. A lot of people think it's a good thing to do, I said. I'm still here. Don't let it go to your head, Samuelson said, and hung up. I listened to the rest of my messages. All of them were from Potshot. Two from Lou Buckman, two from Roscoe Land, the Potshot mayor, and one from Luther Barnes. All of them were wondering how things were going and when I might come back there with my colleagues and clean up the Dell. I didn't return the calls. Chapter 34. Pearl was aging. Her muzzle was gray, her hearing was less acute, her eyesight wasn't as good as it used to be, and her left front shoulder was arthritic, causing her to limp when she walked. But she was a hunting dog, and the genes persist. She could still track an open packet of peanut butter nabs across any terrain. "Not too much longer," Susan said, watching Pearl ease up onto the couch. "Pretty soon we'll have to boost her." We were drinking Iron Horse champagne in Susan's living room. Tomorrow I was heading to Potshot, and the farewell supper that Susan had made waited on the counter in her kitchen, blocked off by chairs. Pearl hadn't lost that much. "We won't mind," I said. "No," Susan said. "What's for supper?" She smiled. "Do you ask out of eagerness or fear?" "Just looking for information," I said. "Lobster salad and corn." "Native corn?" "Yes, from Verrill Farm." "Prepared by you?" I said. "I bought the lobster salad," Susan said. "I was hoping you'd boil the corn." Pearl didn't like the position she had assumed on the couch. She stood and turned around a couple of times and lay back down, as far as I could tell, in the same position, and sighed with relief. "I already have to boost her onto the bed." "Isn't she kind of heavy?" I said. "Yes," Susan said. Susan usually hung around the house in sweats that cost more than my suit and looked better. But she had her own sense of occasion, and tonight, because I was going away for a while, she wore a little black dress and pearls. Her arms and shoulders and neck were strong. Her makeup was perfect. Her face was dominated by her eyes. Her face hinted strongly at intelligence and heat. Excellent combination. "I heard somebody define heaven once," she said, looking at Pearl, "as a place where, when you get there, all the dogs you ever loved run to greet you." "As good as any," I said. She sipped her champagne. Pearl shifted a little on the couch and lapped her nose a couple of times. "Do you think there's anything after death?" Susan said. "Yikes," I said. "No. Talk about it. Surely doing what you do, you've thought about it." "As little as possible," I said. "But you've thought about it." "Sure." "And?" I took in a little champagne. "There are some scientists," I said, "who've discovered an element of light that is faster than light." "Einstein said that's not possible," Susan said. It arrives at the receiver before it leaves the transmitter, I said.
What about cause and effect?
I shrugged. Afterlife is no less implausible than anything else, I said. All explanations of existence are equally incredible.
So you might as well believe something that makes you feel good as not, Susan said.
No harm to it, I said. We were quiet, drinking champagne, looking at Pearl, who had fallen asleep.
Well, Susan said, we'll find out someday.
Or we won't, I said, in which case we won't know it. Susan's glass was empty. She held it out to me. I took the champagne from the ice bucket and poured her another dollop.
I don't know whether you've cheered me up or depressed me, Susan said.
If your feelings are inspired by Pearl's forthcoming demise, I can offer a less complex solution.
I know.
Mourn for an appropriate time, I said, and buy another brown German short hair, Susan said, and name her Pearl. Reincarnation, I said.
Maybe I'm not just thinking about Pearl, Susan said.
Is it Margaret that you mourn for, I said.
No, Susan said.
Does it have anything to do with me leaving for Potshot tomorrow?
Yes.
Would drinking and eating and making love ease your concerns, I said.
Susan smiled at me.
Oddly enough, she said, it would. It made me feel pretty good, too. Chapter 35. Hawk had acquired a black Ford Explorer properly registered with a new inspection sticker. I didn't ask him about it. He and I and Vinny, with gear, were on the road the next day by 8 in the morning. Hawk was driving. Vinny was in the back seat. The sun was shining directly into our faces. I was drinking coffee and eating 2 donuts. Donuts make excellent travel food.
We could have flown, Vinny said. Take us 4 or 5 hours.
With a bunch of infernal devices, Hawk said.
You mean guns? Vinny said.
Sure enough, Hawk said.
Hell, Vinny said. You could have driven the guns out and I could have flown out next week, first class, and met you there.
We may all wish you did, I said. And now we're out of Boston and you're already bitching. Vinny almost smiled.
We there yet? He said.
I had a CD in the player. Carol Sloan and Clark Terry.
She can sing for a white broad, Hawk said.
The best, I said.
Keeps right up with the black guy, Hawk said.
Astonishing, isn't it, I said. We turned off the Mass Pike at Sturbridge and went west on Route 84. We weren't in a hurry. We drove through Connecticut, which was low and green and suburban. We went across New York State and crossed the Hudson River near Fishkill. We crossed the Delaware near Port Jervis, and after a while picked up Route 81 at Scranton. The country had grown hillier. We played CDs— Carol Sloan and Sarah and Bob Stewart and Sinatra, Mel Torme and Ella, and some Clifford Brown. Hawk insisted on a couple of Afro-Cuban CDs that gave me a stomachache, but I tried to stay open-minded. We talked about sex and baseball and food and drink and the days when Hawk and I were fighters. When we exhausted that topic, we talked about sex and basketball and the days when we were soldiers. We stopped along the way for more coffee and more donuts and peanut butter nabs and pre-wrapped ham sandwiches and pre-condimented cheeseburgers and chicken deep-fried in cholesterol.
We got to find better chop, Hawk said. We keep eating this crap, we'll be dead before we get there.
Maybe the next place will have a salad bar, I said.
With some of that orange French dressing, Hawk said,
which is also excellent for slicking your hair back.
My hair, Hawk said.
If you had some.
Used to have an afro, Hawk said.
I remember, I said. You looked like a short Artis Gilmore.
Handsome, Hawk said, and distinguished, but too easy to get hold of in a scuffle. My present do is more practical.
In the back, Vinny looked out the window and said very little. Vinny wasn't much for small talk. We stopped the first night at Hagerstown, Maryland, near the Antietam battlefield, and slept in a Holiday Inn. We drove south. We listened to Tony Bennett and Carmen McRae, Anita O'Day, Stan Kenton, Bobby Hackett, and Johnny Hartman.
Going through West Virginia near Martinsburg, Vinny said,
"You guys ever listen to anything recorded this century?"
Hawk said,
"No. Don't you have nothing like Pink Floyd or Procol Harum?"
"How about the Ink Spots?" Hawk said. Vinny shook his head and settled back to look out the window. We drove down the horsey green Shenandoah Valley with the Alleghenies to the west and Blue Ridge to the east. We hit Knoxville that evening. We crossed the Mississippi at Memphis a day later. Fort Smith, Little Rock, Oklahoma City. I felt like Bobby Troop. Shoney's, Shakey's, McDonald's, Burger King, KFC. I felt my arteries clogging. Gulf, Mobile, Esso, Pilot. Truck stops with buffet tables where you could overeat vastly for maybe $6. Hawk and I had a running bet as to who could count the most desirable women. By the time we crossed the Texas Panhandle, I had already spotted two. Hawk said it wasn't fair, that my standards were too low. "You have to adjust," I said, "to your environment." We went through Amarillo, Big John's Steakhouse, to Cumcari, uphill to Albuquerque. We slept in Holiday Inns and Quality Courts and Hampton Courts and Motel Sixes. We drank coffee and Coke and bottled water. We pulled into rest stops and mingled with fat people who wore pink shorts and plastic baseball caps. I was leading the desirable woman contest 2-1. Sometimes the people wore plaid shorts and plastic baseball caps. They were of both genders, I think. Motorhomes got in our way. They moved like odd beetles, slowly, hugging the edge of the highway, driven uneasily by aging people, many of whom were almost certainly wearing pink shorts. Big rigs with 15 gears slowed us down on the upgrades and tore past us on the downgrades trying to make time, which, as we know, is money. Small sub-sandwiches, biscuits and gravy. Biscuits and sausage with gravy. Chicken fried steak with cream gravy. "Used to sleep with a woman was a professor at Harvard," Hawk said. "Red-haired woman. Taught literature." I was driving. Hawk was in the passenger seat. Vinny was in the back seat, gazing out the window. "She felt I," and his voice deepened and his accent disappeared, "was the perfect embodiment of untrammeled sensuality, unrestrained by the stale ethics or conventions of the state." "I thought that was you," I said.
"What the fuck she talking about?" Vinny said.
"Meant she liked a lot of unusual ways to do it," Hawk said.
"Nothing wrong with that," Vinny said.
"Nothing," Hawk said. The next morning we came down out of the mountains west of Albuquerque, and by evening were in the desert. Chapter 36. The house was on the east edge of town with a good view out the back windows of the Sawtooths to the east. It was a big, sprawling place with a wide front porch. Bernard J. Fortunato was on the front porch when we pulled up. He was wearing a red checkered shirt and blue jeans and a cowboy hat and boots. A blue bandana was knotted around his throat.
"Who the fuck is that?" Vinny said. "Roy Rogers?"
"It's that tough little dude from Vegas," Hawk said. "Bernard J. Fortunato," I said. "We're all gathering. It'll be like the big chill."
"Just like," Hawk said.
"About time you got here," Bernard said. "I've been cooling my heels in this burg for a couple days now."
"Been shopping some," Hawk said.
"Yeah, Hawk, how you doing? Good to see you again." I introduced Vinny, who already had the rear lid of the Explorer open and was starting to unload. And we carried everything into the house. It was sort of shabby inside, but big. 6 bedrooms and 2 baths upstairs, and a big study downstairs that would convert to a bedroom. There was also a living room, a dining room, a large kitchen, another full bath, and central air.
"Furnished," Bernard said. "$6 a month, large."
$6 grand a month," I said. "We better clean this up quick."
"Hey, that's with the furniture, all the pots and pans. All we got to do is pay the fucking utilities."
"Anybody else show up yet?" I said.
"The hard case from Atlanta pulled in yesterday," Bernard said. "Where do you find these guys?"
"I picked them up at Tony Robbins' seminars," I said. "Where's Sepp?"
"Out running," Bernard said. "It's 110,000 fucking degrees," Vinny said.
Bernard shrugged. "What have we got for bedrooms?" I said. "Sap's upstairs front," Bernard said. "I took the couch into den. I'm compact, and I don't sleep much anyway."
"Compact," Hawk said.
We took our luggage, left the other gear on the floor in the living room, and located ourselves in bedrooms. I took a front bedroom where you could overlook the town. There was a double bed with maple headboard and footboard and fluted posts with wooden flames at the top at each corner, a maple dresser, and a disreputable-looking gray and black steamer trunk at the foot of the bed. The windows had shades, but no curtains. Normally when I travel, I don't unpack, but I was going to be here a bit, so I put my stuff in the maple bureau and went back downstairs. Bernard, Teddy Sapp, Hawk, and Vinny were sitting on the wide porch in the cooling evening having a drink.
"You want something?" Bernard said.
He had set up a little drink table on the porch with ice in a bucket. I made myself a scotch and soda and sat down. "I guess you've all met."
"We have," Sapp said. "Two more coming?"
"Yeah, driving over from L.A.
"Desert cools off good in the dark, doesn't it?" Sapp said. "Georgia, it's hot all night."
"Hope the A.C. keeps pumping," Hawk said.
"It don't. I can fix it," Vinny said.
"You know how to fix air conditioners," Hawk said.
"Anything," Vinny said. "Cars, machine guns, phones, TVs. I can fix shit."
We all looked at Vinny as if he had just come out of the closet. He shrugged. We drank our drinks and sat quietly. The desert air was clear and the stars were bigger than I was used to. A nightbird kept chirping something that sounded like tuckahoo. I felt like singing Home on the Range.
"You hungry?" Sapp asked.
"The drive out was a movable feast," I said. "Why would we be hungry?"
"I made a meatloaf," Sapp said, "and there's some beans."
"Well, aren't you the homebody?" Hawk said.
"Yeah, Bernie hated my pink apron," Sapp said. "Straight guys are so fucking straight."
"Bernard," Fortunato said.
"There's biscuits, too," Sapp said.
Chapter 37 I was in the Chiricahua County Sheriff's Department, talking with their chief homicide investigator. The room was cinder block. The windows were tinted. The air conditioning was high. The metal desk and chairs and file cabinet and small conference table were forest green, perfectly complementing the light green walls. All of it was brightly lit by a bank of overhead fluorescents, which perfectly complemented the sunlight coming in through the windows. The chief investigator's name was Cawley Dark. He was a thin, leathery-looking guy wearing starched blue jeans and snakeskin cowboy boots, a white Oxford shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and a Glock 9 high on his waist just in front of his right hip. On the forest-green metal bookcase behind his desk was a big photograph of three teenaged girls clustering around a blonde horse with a white mane.
"Buckman was shot three times," he said, "with a 9mm weapon. We did an autopsy, couldn't match the slugs to anything. Wife says he was threatened by some people from the Dell. We say, 'Who?' She says, 'I don't know.' We say, 'Would you recognize them?' She says, 'Certainly.'"
"Pick up anyone from the Dell?" I said.
Dark smiled. "Everybody we picked up was from the Dell," he said. "It's what we use for a ghetto out here."
"And?"
"And she says none of them are the guys. She thinks."
"Anybody else look at them?"
"Nope."
He got shot in the middle of the day on the main street in Potshot, and no one saw anything.
"Amazing, isn't it?" Dark said.
"You have any reason to believe it wasn't the way it's been described?" I said.
"Nothing I know says it didn't happen that way," Dark said.
"But?"
"But nothing I know says it's right," Dark said. "You want coffee?"
"No, thanks." He got up and went to a coffee maker on top of the file cabinet and poured himself some coffee from a stained pot and came back and sat down. He took a sip and shuddered.
"God damn, that's awful," he said.
"Glad I declined," I said.
"After you called," Dark said, "I checked on you in Boston. Got booted around a little. Ended up talking to a state guy named Healy."
"One of my biggest fans," I said. Dark made a wobbling mezza-mezza gesture with his right hand.
"What do you think about Potshot?" he said.
"A mess," I said. "What do you think of the police chief down there?"
"Walker? Odd duck. I don't know how good he is, but he's better than anyone else. The last two quit and left the area." Always been a small force? No, Dark said. For a while they had an actual police force. Then one of them got killed, and most of the rest sort of dropped out and went away one at a time. Who killed him? Probably the Dell, but we have no evidence. Why don't you roust them out of there anyway, I said. Dark grinned. I'm just a homicide cop, he said. That's SWAT team stuff. And why doesn't the SWAT team do it? Got no legal basis for it, for one thing, he said. Far as we can prove, nobody in the Dell has committed an indictable offense. And just to complicate things, the preacher claims that the Dell is a religious organization, and any effort to control them is an abridgment of their religious freedom. And no one wants to get into another Waco situation, I said. You bet, Dark said. So you think Walker is in the bag, I said. With the Dell? He survived in a job that no one seems able to keep. You feel the others were run off by the Dell? That's what I figure, Dark said. And you can't prove it. Nope. Even talked to one of the previous police chiefs, fella named Mazel. He wasn't talking about anything, but he seemed to be living comfortable. You think they bribed him? I had to guess, Dark said. I think they did both. They told him if he stuck around, they'd kill him, so he left. But to keep him quiet, they give him a separation bonus. But Walker has stayed, I said. Yep. He's either tougher than a rabid skunk, Dark said, or they like him just the way he is, I said. Maybe they figured they couldn't keep running these guys off without one of them deciding to testify. They're paying them off anyway. So they got a guy they didn't need to run off and paid him to stay and keep his mouth shut, Dark said. Or maybe he's just stubborn, I said. I'll be more likely to believe that if he was dead. Cynical, I said. Probably. You alone? No, I have a few friends with me, I said. According to Healy, you can't help yourself. You'll annoy the preacher enough so sooner or later he'll take a run at you. Guys just like to have fun, I said. Well, if they kill you, try and get them to leave clues around, Dark said. I'd love to bust everybody down there. Chapter 38 It was time to confer with our employers, and since we were hoping to keep our profile low, we invited them to our place. It was a still, hot morning. In the scrub above our house, some kind of desert bird was making a raspy sound appropriate to the desert. Lou Buckman was the first to arrive. She pulled up in front of our house in a stripped-down yellow Jeep with no top and no doors. She got out of the Jeep wearing a big hat and riding clothes. A single blonde braid showed below the hat, and her makeup worked beautifully with her face. Her eyes were very big and the color of morning glories. We were arrayed in a friendly manner on the front porch, and if she found us daunting, she didn't show it. "Good morning," she said. "Good morning." I introduced her to the other men. Bernard J. Fortunato said, "I got coffee. You want some?" "Yes, thank you," Lou said. "That would be lovely." Bernard hustled off as if he were going for the Holy Grail. Lou stood on the porch and looked at us. "There aren't very many of you," she said.
"But what there is churse," Hawk said.
"Churse?"
"Choice," I said. "It's a line Spencer Tracy used about Katharine Hepburn."
"Oh."
Lou still looked at us.
"You do look dangerous," she said.
"Señorita," Cholo said, "that is because, as we say in my country, we are dangerous."
"What is your country?" Lou said.
Cholo grinned at her.
"Los Angeles," he said.
Lou leaned her admirable little butt on the railing of the porch. Bernard came back and gave her coffee. She thanked him and held the mug in both hands and sipped. Behind her, a Ford Expedition pulled into the yard, and a Dodge van, and a big Chrysler sedan. Our employers got out, warily, as if it might be an ambush, and gathered uneasily in front of the porch. J. George was there on the left, looking prosperous and affable. In fact, all four of them looked prosperous, and they bore with them the aroma of self-satisfaction that prosperity brings. The mayor stood next to J. George, then Barnes the lawyer and Brown the banker. I stood beside Lou Buckman on the top step of the porch, facing them. My posse was ranged along the back wall of the porch, seated, most of them teetering their chairs back so that the front legs cleared the floor. I looked down at the group.
I felt a little like Mussolini. Maybe I should have folded my arms. "Me, you know," I said. "From my right, Hawk, Vinnie Morris, Cholo, Bobby Horse, Teddy Sapp, and Bernard J. Fortunato." The quartet looked as if they thought that the preacher and his crew might be preferable. Luther Barnes spoke first. "Could we have full names, please?" he said. "Certainly," I said. "Hawk, your full name, please."
"Hawk."
"Thank you. Cholo?"
"Cholo."
"Thank you." Barnes was not amused.
"I just think we have a right to know who we're paying all this money to," he said.
"You're paying it to me," I said.
Roscoe, wearing a Panama hat, probably felt the need to say something official-sounding. "I feel there should be some legal foundation for this venture," he said.
I stared at him. "This group has no legal foundation. It's a group of professional thugs hired by you." The group was quiet. Then Henry Brown said,
"I'm a businessman and a goddamn good one. In all the years of business, I never hired a man I didn't know his background."
"Good for you," I said.
"Damn it," he said. "That's no answer."
Sitting on the porch, Cholo took out a handgun and casually shot a small branch off a tree to my right. He did it again, and then again, chopping the branch back further with each shot.
"I am a simple peasant, senor," Cholo said in his stage Mexican accent. "That is all I have for background."
The gunshots lingered, resonating in the hard, dry heat. Our employers looked at the tree limb. When they looked back at Cholo, the gun was out of sight. Cholo smiled pleasantly. No one had anything to say for a time, until the successful businessman spoke again, somewhat more softly.
"They won't know we're involved, will they?"
"They probably will," I said. "They seem to know a lot."
"But might they retaliate?"
"We'll protect you," I said.
"Seven of you?"
"Not all of us at once," I said. "We try to be fair."
Luther said, "I don't think you realize how serious this is."
I snapped.
"God damn it. You hired a bunch of thugs to come out and protect you. And we get here, and good heavens, we seem to be thugs. And now you're all in a goddamn twidget about it.
You can let us find out who killed Lou Buckman's husband and clean out the dell, or you can live with what you've got. We'll just find out who killed her husband and go home." "I can't pay all of you," Lou Buckman said. Hawk grinned at her.
"No charge," he said,
and looked at the other men. Vinnie nodded first. Then Cholo nodded, and Bobby Horse, and Sapp, and, after a pause, when I could almost see him thinking it over, Bernard J. Fortunato. "So," I said, "there it is. You want us to clean up the dell? Say so. You don't? Beat it."
"If you stay and help her, they'll think we are involved anyway," Luther said. "They know everything that goes on in this town. They probably know we're here."
"Not my problem," I said.
"Unless we pay you."
"Like you told me you would," I said. The attorney turned to his associates. I thought that the level of self-satisfaction in the group had declined a bit.
"He's got us over a barrel," the lawyer said. "We'll have to pay him."
The mayor said,
"Another way to put that, I suppose, is that we are living up to our end of the deal."
"Whatever," Luther said brusquely.
"I'm good for my share." "The bank is prepared to pay you as well," Brown said.
No one spoke. I looked back at my crew. They showed nothing. Then Teddy Sapp said,
"There goes the dell."
Chapter 39. Late in the afternoon, I sat in Dean Walker's office enjoying the AC. One of his patrol cops was at a desk up front doing paperwork with a translucent Bic ballpoint. "You know the Dell collects protection money from town businesses," I said.
"Know it, yes. Prove it, no."
"Do they have a regular collection schedule?"
"Every Thursday."
"So why not catch them doing it and bust them?" The patrol cop stopped writing for a moment, then continued.
"Several reasons," Walker said. He had his feet up on the corner of his desk, dark leather cowboy boots gleaming in the sun that filtered in through the tinted windows in the front. "One," Walker said, "they do it privately in somebody's office with the door closed. 2, even if I arrested somebody, there'd be no witnesses and I couldn't hold them. 3, there's 40 of them and 5 of us. I nodded.
I didn't know you knew Lou Buckman from L.A., I said.
Walker didn't register anything, but he took a moment to answer.
You've been investigating, he said.
You lived in her neighborhood.
I did, Walker said.
And you were a cop there, I said.
Uh-huh.
L.A. or Santa Monica?
L.A. I was a detective, Rampart's division.
So how'd you end up here, I said.
Walker shrugged.
It was time to stop being a big city cop, he said. Hell, it was time to stop being a cop altogether, but I didn't know how to do anything else.
Well, at least you've reduced the scale, I said. The Buckmans have anything to do with you coming here?
They had a little business out here, Summers. They mentioned there was an opening.
Perfect, I said. Did they mention the Dell?
When I took this job, the Dell was just a bunch of stumble bums squatting in the old mining shacks. They didn't turn into a problem until the preacher showed up.
You happen to remember Lou Buckman's maiden name, I said.
Allard, he said. Mary Lou Allard.
Nice woman, I said.
He nodded.
Nice woman.
You know Mark Ratliff in L.A., too?
Yep.
You know how he ended up here in the same town as two of his neighbors in Santa Monica?
Must have heard about it from Lou and Steve, Walker said. Like me.
And he wanted to get out of the Hollywood rat race, I said.
Walker smiled.
He was trailing the other rats by considerable, Walker said.
What kind of guy is he?
Walker shrugged again.
Hollywood guy, Walker said.
I heard he had a fling with Lou.
Walker's face hardened. I could see the lines deepen on either side of his mouth.
That's a fucking lie, he said.
I nodded.
The best kind, I said.
He was shagging around after her at a couple of parties we went to, but she brushed him off. Stevie was going to punch his lights out.
We?
We what?
You said we went to a couple of parties.
You married?
Divorced.
Grounds, I said.
She knows and I know, Walker said. You don't need to.
What is your ex-wife's name, I said.
Same answer.
I nodded. When you've got one that works, may as well stay with it.
I'm sick of talking to you, pal, Walker said.
Beat it.
Arguing with him about that didn't lead anywhere. The patrol cop was still concentrating on his report sheet so hard that I wondered as I left whether it might begin to smolder.
Chapter 40. I went back to the house. On the front porch, Hawk and Teddy Sapp were doing push-ups. It looked like an interesting contest, since both of them appeared able to do push-ups forever. Bernard J. Fortunato had drinks set up on the table on the porch. There was scotch and vodka and soda and tonic, a cooking pot full of ice, and some lemons sliced in wedges and a large soup bowl of peanuts. There were no napkins, but he had put out a number of neatly folded paper towels. Vinny was drinking scotch on the rocks. Cholo and Bobby Horse each had vodka and tonic.
"This is taking too long," Hawk said.
He and Sapp looked at each other and grinned and stood up at the same time.
"Not bad," I said to Teddy. "Not many people can stay with Hawk."
"Not good either," Sapp said. "Nobody ever stayed with me before."
Sapp made a couple of scotch and sodas and handed one to Hawk. I went in and got a can of beer and came out and sat on the porch railing with one foot hanging free.
"Cholo and Bobby Horse went off somewhere in a car," Bernard reported.
I looked at Cholo.
"I went up and reconnoitered the Dell," Cholo said, "with my faithful Indian companion."
"How'd it look?" I said.
"Hard to get to," Cholo said.
"I know."
"And they got sentries out all night."
"I assume you weren't spotted?"
"Spotted? Señor, I was with the great Kiowa scout, he who walks everywhere and is never spotted."
Bobby Horse had no reaction. It was as if he didn't hear us.
"Silly question," I said.
"I maybe found a way to get above them and shoot down."
"Can you find it again?" I said.
Bobby Horse drank some vodka and tonic.
"I am a Native American," he said.
"Oh, yeah," I said. "I forgot.
Can you show me?
If you can walk as softly as I can,
Bobby Horse said. He never smiled. I never knew for sure how much of his white man speak him with forked tongue Indian routine was shtick. I was pretty sure most of it was. I looked at his bare chest. Tomorrow you can take me and Hawk up there, I said. He nodded. His upper body was bunched with muscle. There was a white scar that ran across the coppery skin of his chest, from near the left shoulder almost to his bottom rib on the right side. You been out all day with no shirt, I said. He nodded again. Don't Native Americans get sunburned, I said.
Use 'em sunblock.
Chapter 41. In the morning, I called Fresno State University and said I was planning to hire Mary Lou Allard and asked about her undergraduate career. The registrar spoke with enough accent for me to know that English was her second language.
Miss Allard graduated cum laude with a Bachelor of Science degree in geology, she said.
Date?
June 3rd, 1985.
Is there anything else you can tell me about her, I said.
No, sir, there is not.
Thanks, anyway, I said. I then called information and asked for Walker in Santa Monica. My question was too hard for the electronic apparatus to which I had asked it, and after a few clicks and bleeps, I got a live female voice.
What listing, please?
Judy Walker in Santa Monica, I said.
What state, please?
California.
Do you have a street address?
No. There was a moment of silence in which I knew I was being disapproved of. Then she said,
One moment, please.
A mechanical voice came back on and gave me a telephone number. I broke the connection and dialed the number. She answered on the third ring. My name is Spencer, I said. I'm a detective working on a case out here in the desert. I understand that your ex-husband is the chief of police in Potshot.
My ex-husband? Yes, I guess he is. I haven't seen him for 9 years.
I'm doing a little background check. You're divorced from Chief Walker?
Yes.
What were the grounds? I said.
Why on earth would you want to know that?
I laughed. Good question, I said. I guess because my boss will fire me if I don't find out. She laughed very slightly on her end of the phone.
We were divorced on the grounds that he coveted his neighbor's wife.
Really, I said. And what was her name, if you remember?
I remember, she said.
Of course. She was silent. I waited.
Mary Lou, she said. Mary Lou Buckman.
I see, I said, just like I didn't know. And I'm sorry to be so indelicate, but I have to ask, was his covetousness, fulfilled?
You mean, was he shacking up with her?
Yes. You're sure?
Of course I'm sure. That's why I divorced the bastard.
And I certainly don't blame you, I said.
Sincere as a siding salesman.
Do you know where Ms. Buckman is now?
Sure. She's out there in Potshot. The dumb bastard followed her out there.
Are they together, I said. She was warm on the subject now, and I didn't have to be so delicate. Pretty soon I'd have trouble getting her to shut up.
Together? No, of course not. She's married, and with her husband. My stupid husband just followed her out there, in case she decided to cheat on her husband again.
And if she didn't? He could just moon around her like a big fruit fly. Men are idiots.
True, I said. That's so true.
Her husband even threatened Dean once, told him to stay away from his wife.
How did your husband react?
Oh, he's a policeman, thinks he's a tough guy like they all do. I think they're a bunch of babies.
Did they actually have a fight or anything?
Not while I was around.
Did either of them threaten to kill the other?
Kill? Oh, God, no, it wasn't like that. I never said anything about killing. Why are you talking about killing?
Just routine, ma'am.
Is Dean all right? She said.
He's fine, ma'am, fine.
Well, is that all? I've got a lot of things waiting for me.
Yes, ma'am, thank you for your time.
She hung up without saying, You're welcome. Since I was on a hot streak, I called the Department of Water and Power in L.A. and talked with a guy in the personnel department.
"I'm interviewing a Mary Lou Buckman," I said, "for a job. Her resume says she worked for you. Could you verify that for me?" "Did she say what section?" "No." "Give me a minute," he said. It was more like 10, but finally he came back on the line.